Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we sift through the most critical sources of the week to hand you the insights you need to stay ahead. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Alex Astor. Today we're doing a really thorough exploration of Barron's Magazine for the week of October 6th, 2025.
Yeah, our goal here is to cut through all the noise, all those headlines, and really pull out the actionable knowledge, the surprising stuff that actually matters to you.
Mm-hmm. And this issue really lays out, well, a fascinating tension, doesn't it?
It really does. You've got this incredible optimism on one side. AI is booming. Capital markets are creating immense wealth. The stock market just keeps hitting records. It feels almost like pure euphoria.
But then you look just beneath the surface, and the actual economic foundation seems, well, complex. Shaky, even. Risk is popping up in really unexpected places.
Like where specifically?
We're talking about the core structures of debt, mm-hmm. you know, the stability of the U.S. Treasury market itself, which is fundamental. Then there's this quiet distress brewing in private credit. Mm-hmm. And even down to personal finances, the strain on, say, family safety nets, it's quite a mix.
It really is. Half euphoria, half this sort of underlying anxiety. So let's start digging into this landscape. Maybe we can begin with that big disruption happening in credit scoring. It sounds pretty significant.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start there. It centers on Fair Isaac, the company behind the FICO score everyone knows.
Right.
They've been under a lot of pressure, especially from regulators. The FHFA director, Bill Pulte, was very vocal. He basically called them a monopoly that's been ripping off Americans. Strong words.
Wow. Yeah, you don't usually hear that kind of language from a regulator. So Fair Isaac had to respond somehow.
They did. And their response was pretty fundamental. They've completely changed their pricing model, effectively bypassing the credit bureaus, so the Equifax, TransUnion, Experian.
Okay, bypassing them how? What's the actual mechanism there?
Well, traditionally, if a mortgage lender needed your FICO score, they had to get it through one of those bureaus. Mm-hmm. The new system lets the lenders calculate and give out the FICO scores directly to borrowers themselves. The bureaus are just cut out of that specific transaction.
Interesting. So what did the lenders pay now for this direct access?
They've got a couple options. They can pay $10 per score, which Fair Isaac says is roughly what the bureaus were charging anyway.
Okay.
Or they can pay a lower upfront fee, just under $5, but then pay an extra $33 per borrower per score, only if the loan actually closes.
Ah, so Fair Isaac gets a bigger slice when the deal actually happens.
Exactly. They're monetizing the closing event directly, taking a much larger share of the revenue generated by their score.
And Director Pulte liked this change. He saw it as progress.
He called it an important first step, yeah. It addressed some of that monopoly concern, but the implications go way beyond just appeasing regulators. Think of the stock reaction, for one.
Huge, right? Fair Isaac's stock soared.
Up 22%. And analysts are estimating this could mean, like, an extra $250 million in revenue for them in fiscal 26. It's a massive win for Fair Isaac. They're taking back control, essentially.
And meanwhile, the credit bureaus, they got hammered.
Oh, yeah. Equifax down over 7%, TransUnion almost 10%. JP Morgan thinks it could cost each of them up to $200 million in revenue.
But is that it for the bureaus? I mean, they still own the underlying data, don't they? That credit history information.
That's their ace in the hole.
Yeah.
They absolutely still own the raw data. FICO needs to even calculate the score. So they have a couple of ways to push back.
Like what?
Well, first, they could just jack up the price they charge Fair Isaac for accessing that data. Eat into Fair Isaac's new profits.
Makes sense.
Second, and this could be more disruptive, they could really aggressively push their own competing score, VantageScore. A lot of lenders are already testing it out.
Right, I've heard of VantageScore.
So if they push that hard, it forces lenders to build systems to handle both scoring models, which is expensive and complicated. Yeah. Though, you know, some analysts, like Morgan Stanley, think the market overreacted on the bureau stocks. Mm. They're seeing maybe a buy-the-dip chance, especially on Experian.
Fascinating. A real power struggle playing out there. Okay, let's zoom out a bit to the broader debt markets, because as you said, there's this weird disconnect highlighted in Barron's this week. Public bonds look great, but private credit, not so much.
It's like two completely different worlds right now. If you look at publicly traded corporate bonds, investment grade, even the speculative junk bonds, they're absolutely booming.
Mm-hmm.
Yield margins over treasuries are super tight, historically slim. That means demand is incredibly high, pushing prices up.
And everyone seems to think this is all down to the Federal Reserve, right? The rate cuts?
Absolutely. We got that quarter point cut in September, and the market's basically baked in two more cuts by the middle of 2026. The target rate expectation is down around, what, 3 to 3.25%? So that expectation of cheaper money makes issuing new corporate debt really attractive. We saw huge bond issuances last month just get snapped up immediately. Massive demand.
Okay, so that's the public market story. Sunshine and optimism. What about the private side? The bank loans, the sort of bespoke stuff?
That's where you start seeing the cracks. Bankruptcies are definitely ticking up among companies that rely on private lenders.
Any examples?
Yeah, Barron's mentions Tricolor Holdings, which was a subprime auto lender. They filed for Chapter 7 liquidation. And then there's First Brands, a big auto parts company, Chapter 11, with $6 billion in leveraged loans outstanding.
6 billion. Wow. And you mentioned some of that debt was packaged into CLOs, collateralized loan obligations.
That's right. About $2 billion of that First Brands debt ended up in CLOs.
Now, people hear CLO and immediately think CMO from 2008. But CLOs have generally been seen as safer, haven't they? Can you quickly remind us why?
Sure. So a CLO bundles up leveraged corporate loans, not subprime mortgages like the bad CMOs. Corporate debt usually has better recovery rates if things go wrong. Plus, CLOs are typically actively managed.
Okay.
But the fact that we're now seeing loans within CLOs going bankrupt, like with First Brands, well, that suggests the underlying credit quality in the private market is really starting to deteriorate. Those safer top slices, the senior tranches of the CLOs, might actually start feeling some pain soon.
And the companies that specialize in this kind of lending, the BDCs, business development companies, they're struggling too.
Yeah, the main BDC ETF, the VanEck one, has actually posted negative returns recently. It's a sign of pressure.
So for investors who are already holding these types of loans, what's the issue with falling interest rates? I thought lower rates were good.
Not necessarily for these specific loans. Most are floating rates. So as the Fed cuts rates, the interest payments the investors receive actually go down.
Okay. Less income.
Right. But, firms like Nuveen are arguing they're still good diversifiers and should yield around 6% even after the cuts. And some fund managers see an opportunity.
How so?
Well, in closed-end funds, CEFs, that specialize in these senior loans, the discounts have widened out. You can buy them for maybe like 92 cents on the dollar on average now.
Because the markets worry about those lower payouts.
Exactly. So some see it as a chance to buy assets cheap.
So public markets are flush, private markets are showing stress. Liquidity seems to be hiding some real problems. Which brings us to maybe the biggest potential risk, the U.S. Treasury market itself. You mentioned its stability is changing.
Fundamentally changing. And it's all about who is buying U.S. debt now. Since 2021, there's been this massive shift.
What kind of shift?
Private foreign investors, think hedge funds, institutions they've piled in, buying an extra $2.3 trillion in treasuries.
2.3 trillion.
Yeah. But at the same time, foreign governments, central banks, they've actually reduced their holdings by about $301 billion.
Okay, central banks pulling back usually signals caution, maybe diversifying away from the dollar a bit. But why does it matter so much if it's a private fund versus a central bank buying the debt? Isn't a buyer a buyer?
Not really. The type of buyer changes the whole dynamic. Central banks are typically very cautious, long-term buy-and-hold investors. They care about stability.
Right.
Private buyers, especially the leveraged ones like hedge funds, are all about maximizing returns. And they use a lot of leverage to do it.
Okay, let's unpack that leverage piece because you said that's key to the instability risk. How are they doing that?
They use complex strategies, mainly things like basis swaps and swap spreads.
Can you simplify that a bit?
Basically, a basis swap lets a fund borrow money very cheaply using their treasury bonds as collateral. Then they use that borrowed cash to make bigger bets, often exploiting tiny price differences between the actual treasury bond and a related derivative.
So they're amplifying their bets using borrowed money.
Massively amplifying. It's profitable when things are calm, but it means they make huge, fast trades. And when there's a shock, unexpected news, a sudden need for cash, these super leveraged positions have to be unwound immediately, which makes any sell-off much worse. Exactly. It pours fuel on the fire. We saw this fragility in March 2020 during the COVID panic, and again after that tariff news back in April, the bond market sold off incredibly quickly.
So the U.S. government's debt, the bedrock of global finance, is becoming less of a safe haven and more like a highly leveraged trading instrument.
That's the core concern. And State Street did research suggesting this shift could push yields higher just on its own. maybe a full percentage point higher on the 10-year treasury over time.
A full percentage point. That's huge, especially given how much debt the U.S. has.
That's enormous.
Yeah.
Think about this. Since last October, just October 2024, the U.S. government has paid $933 billion just in interest on the debt.
$933 billion in less than a year. That's more than almost any other government program except Medicare and Social Security. So making the Treasury market more volatile and potentially pushing yields higher, that has massive budget implications. The foundation is now reliant on traders, not stable central banks. It's a profound shift in risk.
Almost $1 trillion in interest. That's staggering. Okay, let's pivot from that foundational anxiety and debt to the engine of all the excitement, AI.
Right. The AI story is still dominant, but the question Barron's seems to be asking is, you know, are we still in a phase of justified confidence, or are we tipping into actual froth?
And a big signal just came from OpenAI, didn't it?
A huge one. They did a secondary stock offering, basically letting employees cash out some shares, and the implied valuation, around $500 billion.
$500 billion for a company still figuring out its long-term business model.
Exactly. And initially, that news sent ripples of optimism through all the big tech names.
Mm-hmm.
But then something interesting happened.
What was that?
The reaction kind of fizzled. You know, the big AI darlings like NVIDIA, they opened higher but then sort of faded during the day. And the main semiconductor index actually closed lower than it opened.
Huh. So initial excitement, then second thoughts?
That's what it looks like. It's a hesitation signal. Investors seem increasingly unwilling to just chase these AI stocks at what are, let's face it, historically really expensive levels.
Right.
Kinsale Trading even noted this raises the risk of a pretty significant pullback, you know, profit taking in tech, which could drag the whole market down. People are starting to wonder if the current earnings really justify the massive future growth that's already priced in.
And maybe that skepticism is fueled by the sheer cost of doing AI. The infrastructure costs are astronomical, aren't they?
Oh, astronomical is the word. Look at Meta. They spent $37 billion last year on AI infrastructure.
Okay.
For 2025, they're projecting around $70 billion. $70 billion.
Yeah.
Just on building out data centers for AI.
And unlike, say, Amazon or Microsoft, who can rent out some of that capacity through cloud services.
Meta basically eats that entire cost themselves. They don't have a big cloud rental business to offset it.
Is that showing up on their balance sheet yet?
It is. For the first time ever as a public company, Meta actually reported having more debt and lease liabilities than cash on hand in the second quarter. Mm-hmm. That $70 billion spend is real, and investors want to see a return on it quickly.
So what's Zuck's plan? How do they make money from this massive investment?
It looks like the classic Web 2.0 playbook. Yeah. Scale first, monetize second.
Okay.
Right now, the focus is scaling Meta AI, integrating it everywhere, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. They claim it already has over 1 billion monthly users.
1 billion users already? That's fast.
It's incredibly fast. And if you look at what they did with Threads.
Their Twitter competitor.
Right.
Right.
Launched mid-2023, hit its user targets, and then bam, ads started appearing early this year.
So we should expect ads within the Meta AI chats soon.
Almost certainly. They're already using the data from those chats to improve ad targeting elsewhere on their platforms.
Hmm.
Putting ads directly into the chat conversation seems like the logical next step.
Hmm. Advertising next to potentially very personal chatbot conversations, that feels a bit different.
It does. It raises interesting questions about user comfort levels compared to, say, ads in a social media feed. It's a finer line to walk.
Meanwhile, OpenAI isn't just waiting around. They're making moves into e-commerce, right?
Aggressively.
Hmm.
They hired Fiji Simo, who used to run Instacart and was a big deal at Meta before that, to be their CEO of applications. That was a big signal.
And her first move was?
Announcing a partnership with Stripe for something called Instant Checkout.
How does that work?
It means if you're using ChatGPT, you can search for products from partners. They started with Etsy. Shopify is coming soon. And you can actually buy the item right there in the chat using Stripe to process the payment. You never leave ChatGPT.
Wow, okay. So that positions them perfectly for an ad and e-commerce revenue model, too.
Exactly. It's that same pattern. Offer a free service, build a huge user base, then monetize through ads and facilitating transactions. But that underlying vulnerability is still there for everyone.
The massive cost of building and running the AI.
Hundreds of billions being poured into infrastructure.
Mm.
There's a real risk, as some analysts point out, that these huge initial costs could just wipe out all the early profits.
And this need for AI assets, for computing power, for specialized software, It's driving a ton of M&A activity, right? Mergers and acquisitions.
A huge surge. Global tech deals are up something like 41% year over year. Over $500 billion in deals announced. Stable interest rates are definitely helping make these big buys possible.
Any standout examples?
The biggest recent one mentioned is Palo Alto Networks buying CyberArk software for $25 billion.
Okay.
That gives Palo Alto immediate access to CyberArk's cybersecurity tools, integrating them into their platform. It's all about acquiring capabilities quickly.
And analysts are pointing to other companies that might be takeover targets?
Yeah, Wedbush analyst Dan Ives put out a list. It includes cybersecurity firms like SentinelOne, Qualys, Tenable. Also some consumer names like TripAdvisor and Lyft, which might appeal more to private equity buyers.
Any specific AI-focused companies on that list?
He highlighted two, C3.ai and Varonis Systems.
Okay, tell me about C3.ai first.
They do enterprise AI software. Their valuation has come down a lot, only about $2.5 billion now, and their business seems to have stabilized recently. Ives thinks that makes them a pretty attractive target for a bigger software company or private equity firm wanting an AI angle without paying those really nosebleed valuations elsewhere.
And Varonis Systems.
They're bigger, about $6.7 billion market cap. Mm-hmm. They focus on security software, using AI to help companies find and manage data risks quickly. Again, very appealing to corporate buyers looking for proven revenue-generating AI, not just hype.
Speaking of hype, maybe bordering on speculation, let's talk about that Fermi IPO. That sounded wild.
Fermi is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the definition of an ambitious, high-risk venture. It IPO'd with a nearly $14 billion valuation, and the stock popped 55% on day one.
But what do they actually do or plan to do?
Their plan is basically just on paper right now. They want to build the world's largest data center campus in the Texas Panhandle.
Okay. And how are they powering this giant data center?
That's the really audacious part. They're planning a mix of natural gas, solar, batteries, and eventually four large nuclear reactors.
Nuclear reactors? Wow.
And they even plan to name one of them the Donald J. Trump Generating Plant. The symbolism is pretty clear. Big power, big ambition.
But let's look at the financials. It's structured as a REIT, right? A real estate investment trust.
Yeah.
That usually implies stability, dividends.
But Fermi has zero revenue right now.
Yeah.
And they won't pay any dividends for years. The REIT structure feels a bit misleading, frankly.
And the timeline for those reactors seems aggressive.
It's extremely aggressive. They're aiming for the first reactor online by 2031. Historically, similar nuclear projects have taken closer to 15 years, often with huge budget overruns.
So what's the critical risk here?
They absolutely need to sign up tenants and start generating revenue by 2027. If they don't, they won't be able to cover their debts, and the whole thing could just unravel.
So the potential outcomes are pretty extreme.
Totally. One consultant quoted in Barron's said, "The plausible stock price range is literally anywhere from $7 to $105 a share. It's a pure gamble on AI demand hitting their aggressive timelines. Plus, successfully building nuclear reactors on schedule and budget. Huge ifs."
Okay, from highly speculative Texas tech ventures, let's shift focus internationally. South Korea's market seems to be doing incredibly well, almost ignoring political risks.
Yeah, the Korean market, the KOSPI index, is up almost 60% year to date. It's been red hot.
And it's holding up despite things like trade tensions, tariff threats.
Amazingly so. It actually climbed 14% since that big U.S. immigration raid on a Hyundai factory back in September. It seems to be just shrugging off the political noise, particularly around the Trump administration's stance.
Why? What's driving that resilience? Barron's points to two main things.
Exactly. Two big forces. First, it's just plugged directly into the global AI mania.
How so?
South Korea is home to Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix. They're semiconductor giants, and together they make up about a third of the whole market index.
Oh, okay.
And they make critical components for AI. For example, Samsung stock jumped 30% recently when its advanced memory chips, the high bandwidth memory needed for training AI models, got approved by NVIDIA. So they're riding that AI supply chain wave directly.
Makes sense. And the second driver is more internal, something about corporate governance.
Yes, and this is potentially huge. For years, people talked about the Korea discount, meaning Korean stocks traded cheaper than global peers because of poor corporate governance, often favoring founding families over regular shareholders. Mm-hmm. But the new government has pushed through some really significant reforms. They've explicitly extended the legal duty of corporate directors to include all shareholders, not just insiders.
That's a big shift.
It is. And they're also looking at limiting how companies can use treasury stock shares the company holds of itself, which families often use to keep voting control without owning a majority of the equity.
And maybe tax changes, too.
Yeah, there's a serious proposal on the table to slash the tax rate on dividends, potentially cutting it in half from a max of 50% down to 25%.
Cutting dividend taxes that much would be a massive incentive for investors, especially long-term ones.
Absolutely. And analysts are predicting that if these governance reforms really stick, Korea's average price-to-book ratio could climb significantly.
How much?
From its current level, around 1.1 times book value, maybe up towards Japan's level of 1.6 times. That kind of jump implies, well, potentially another 40% upside for the Korean market overall. Investors are betting these changes unlock a lot of trapped value.
Wow. Global tech demand plus internal cleanup. Powerful mix. Okay, let's bring it back to the U.S. and look at a specific sector opportunity. Biotech, and specifically Gilead Sciences. They seem to be having a comeback.
Yeah, Gilead's finally shaking off what people were calling its lost decade. The stock is getting close to its old highs from way back in 2015.
And the problem back then was, ironically, their blockbuster drugs were too successful.
Exactly. Sovaldi and Harvoni, their hepatitis C drugs, were revolutionary. They cured hep C for most patients.
It sounds great.
For patients, yes. For Gilead's long-term revenue, not so much. They effectively cured their customer base, so those massive revenue streams dried up and the stock languished for years.
So the story now is about finding sustainable revenue diversification.
Precisely. Those liver disease drugs, like the hep C ones, are now only about 10% of sales. The bulk of their revenue, about two-thirds, now comes from their dominant HIV treatments. Those are ongoing therapies, not cures. And importantly, their oncology, their cancer drug business, has more than doubled since 2020. That's mainly driven by a drug called Trodelvy.
And their pipeline, the drugs in development, looks promising too.
Very promising. True Securities just upgraded the stock, citing the strength in HIV, but also real optimism about a new CAR T-cell therapy called anito-cel.
What's that for?
Multiple myeloma. It's expected to launch next year and potentially be the best-in-class treatment. So the future growth looks more diversified and sustainable.
And from a valuation perspective, is it looking attractive?
It seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
Trading around 13 times expected 2026 earnings, it pays a decent dividend. Mm. And the consensus forecast is for earnings per share to jump something like 75% in 2025.
75%? Wow.
Yeah. And the technical analysts are looking at the charts, seeing good support around the 200-day moving average. They think it could be building a base for a move towards maybe $145 by early 2026.
Definitely sounds like a company turning things around.
Mm.
Okay. Moving from biotech to a really specific niche in real estate, cold storage REITs. Barron's looked at a couple that have been hit hard.
Yeah. Americold Realty Trust, ticker ACO, and Lineage, ticker Line. These companies own those massive refrigerated and frozen warehouses that are critical for the food supply chain.
Right. Essential infrastructure. But their stocks are down a lot.
Way down. Americold is down something like 42% year to date. Lineage down 32%. Both have really underperformed.
Why? What's putting them in the deep freeze?
It seems to be a few different things hitting them all at once. First, there's been some new cold storage capacity built recently, so more competition.
Okay.
Second, you know how everyone stocked their freezers during the pandemic? That's reversed. People aren't hoarding frozen pizzas anymore, so warehouse usage is normalizing.
Makes sense.
And third, this one's kind of interesting. The impact of those GLP-1 weight loss drugs, like Ozempic. The theory is, if people are eating less overall, there's less demand for food storage, especially frozen goods.
Huh. Never thought of that angle. So with all those headwinds, why are they being flagged as potential buys?
It really comes down to valuation. They look incredibly cheap compared to their underlying asset value, and especially compared to other types of REITs.
How cheap?
Well, Americold is trading at less than 10 times its adjusted funds from operations, or AFO. That's the key cash flow metric for REITs.
And what's typical for the REIT sector?
The average REIT trades for well over 20 times AFO. So Americold is trading at like half the sector average.
That's a huge discount.
It is. So analysts are saying Americold looks like the better bet right now. Lower valuation, a really high dividend yield, about 7.4%, and because it's smaller, around $3.5 billion market cap, it's seen as a potential takeover target once these headwinds eventually ease up.
Interesting. And just quickly, the magazine also covered the warehouse club retailers, Costco, Sam's Club.
Yeah, the cover story was about how Walmart is using its tech muscle to boost Sam's Club. But the main takeaway was pretty positive for the whole sector, meaning the conclusion was that all three big players, Sam's Club, Costco, and BJ's Wholesale Club, are actually well-positioned to keep winning. The membership club model itself is just very resilient right now.
Good to know. Okay, let's shift gears now to personal finance and how some of these bigger trends are hitting home, starting with this bank of mom and dad phenomenon. It sounds like it's become more than just occasional help.
Oh, much more. That term used to mean maybe helping with a wedding gift or something. Now, according to a new Ameriprise survey highlighted in Barron's, it's like a full-service, ongoing financial institution for adult kids.
How extensive is the support?
It's pretty shocking, actually. The survey found 75%, three-quarters of wealthy parents are paying for big things like down payments on houses or graduate school tuition for their adult children.
Okay, big one-off items.
But almost two-thirds, nearly 66%, are also covering ongoing regular bills, things like groceries, car payments, phone plans, insurance.
Wow, so it's become almost like a dependency for many adult children.
It seems that way,
yeah.
But it's creating a lot of stress for the parents. About 36% of them said they're worried that supporting their kids like this is going to actually hurt their own retirement plans.
And communication isn't great either.
Apparently not. Many families haven't really set clear boundaries like what expenses are covered or when does the support eventually end. It's leading to anxiety.
What's driving this? Is it just parents being generous or are there bigger economic factors?
It's definitely a mix. Costs for housing and higher education have just skyrocketed, right? So young adults face much bigger hurdles than their parents did.
True.
At the same time, milestones are being delayed. People are starting careers later, getting married later, having kids later. So that period where they might need parental support just stretches out longer.
And the parents, the baby boomers, generally have the wealth to provide that support.
Exactly. They're often called the wealthiest generation in history.
Yeah.
So they have the means to step in. But it's creating this massive intergenerational transfer that might be jeopardizing the boomers' own long-term financial security.
A really tough situation. Okay, sticking with retirement planning, Barron's had some good advice on avoiding mistakes when people make that big move after retiring. They used an anecdote about a couple moving to Maine.
Yeah, it's a classic story. Couple retires, moves to Maine for the idyllic lifestyle, only to find they absolutely hate the brutal winters and end up having to move again. That happens surprisingly often.
Because people romanticize the destination without doing the homework.
Precisely. The emotional pull overrides the practical reality. So the article laid out three basic but really important rules to follow.
Okay, what's rule number one?
Look before you leap. Sounds obvious, but it means really look. If you don't know an area intimately, you absolutely have to rent there first for at least a full year.
To experience all the seasons.
Exactly. See what summer traffic is like, what winter is really like, understand the true cost of living day to day. That main couple clearly didn't grasp the reality of 4 or 5 months of cold and darkness.
Okay, rent first. What's rule number two?
Know all the costs in advance. This trips up so many people, especially those moving to states with no income tax, thinking it'll be super cheap.
Like Florida.
Florida's the perfect example. Yes, no state income tax, which sounds great. But then new residents get hit with a huge property tax bill because protections for longtime homeowners don't apply to new buyers. And the cost of hurricane and flood insurance can be absolutely astronomical, easily wiping out any income tax savings.
And it's not just property and insurance taxes, right? Other taxes can change too.
Definitely. The article mentioned pensions. Like if you have a state pension from New York, it might be tax-free in New York, but move to North Carolina and suddenly that same pension income might become fully taxable there. You need to understand the whole picture, state, local, property taxes before you buy.
Good point. And rule number three deals with aging.
Right. Be prepared for health decline. It's inevitable. As people get into their late 70s, 80s, the need for some kind of support increases. Mm-hmm. The plan has to realistically factor in potentially needing to move into an independent or assisted living facility later on.
And you can't just assume distant family will handle everything.
Exactly. If your kids live hundreds or thousands of miles away, relocating near them might seem nice, but you can't base your plan on them providing daily care later in life. Not planning for that eventual need for professional care is a major reason people end up unhappy and needing to move yet again when they're older and less able.
Really solid practical advice. Okay, let's switch to income investing. Barron's warned about chasing super high dividend yields, calling out a group they named the Suspicious Eight.
Yeah, the Suspicious Eight. These are S&P 500 companies currently yielding over 6%, And the point is, a yield that high is usually a warning sign, not an opportunity.
Why is that?
Well, in a generally healthy market, a yield that high often means one of two things. Either the underlying company is really struggling financially, or the market strongly suspects the dividend is about to be cut.
So the high yield reflects high risk.
Exactly. And history shows that stocks with more moderate yields, or even better, stocks with a consistent track record of increasing their dividends over time, tend to dramatically outperform these super high yielders in the long run. Chasing that huge yield often means you're just buying into a future dividend cut that wipes out your return.
Can you give some examples from their list? Who are these suspicious eights?
Sure. One mentioned was LyondellBasell, yielding a massive 11.3%. But the chemical industry is facing a global glut in polyethylene, which is crushing their profit margins. Analysts are openly talking about a dividend cut, especially since the competitor Dow already cut its dividend in half back in July.
Okay, that makes sense. Who else?
EPS was another one yielding 7.8%. They're dealing with a slump in shipping demand, partly tied to all the global tariff uncertainty. They've had to cut capacity, lay people off. Again, the high yield comes from a falling stock price reflecting business struggles, not from strong fundamentals.
What about Pfizer? They were on the list at 6.3%, but their stock actually jumped recently.
Yeah, the Pfizer situation is interesting. Their yield is high, but the recent stock jump was more of a relief rally.
Relief from what?
They reached a deal with President Trump on drug pricing that turned out to be much milder than the market feared. They avoided really harsh tariffs by agreeing to some price cuts on Medicaid and selling certain drugs through a new government website, TrumpRx.gov. Investors had braced for worse, so the stock bounced when the deal wasn't draconian.
So if chasing these super high yields is risky, what's the smarter approach for income investors?
The advice is pretty consistent. Focus on dividend growth, not just the current yield percentage. Look for companies, or ETFs, that prioritize financial strength and have a history of consistently increasing their payouts over time.
Like which ETFs?
Funds like the Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF, VIG, or the Schwab U.S. Dividend Equity ETF, SCHD, are often mentioned. They screen for quality and sustainability, which is generally a much safer path than grabbing an 8 or 10% yield that might disappear overnight.
Good advice. Okay, last topic in the strategy section. Asset managers. They face headwinds, but barons see some value, and there's this weird phantom tax issue.
Yeah, the asset management industry is definitely facing challenges. The big one is the relentless shift of money from older, actively managed mutual funds into low-cost index ETFs.
Right, the passive investing boom.
Exactly. Plus, you have the demographic wave of baby boomers starting to retire and draw money out of their 401ks, which hits the traditional players. That's why firms like T. Rowe Price and Invesco have generally lagged the S&P 500 over the past decade.
But BlackRock has done well.
BlackRock is the exception that proves the rule. Their dominance with the iShares ETF brand, plus their big pushes into alternative investments and even crypto, has kept them way ahead of the pack.
So why is T. Rowe Price being highlighted as a potential value play now?
Because it looks cheap relative to its earnings and assets. It's trading around 11 times earnings, pays a solid 5% dividend yield, has a very strong brand name, and crucially, it has zero debt on its balance sheet.
Even though money is still flowing out of their funds.
Yeah, the outflows are still a problem, but the valuation seems to reflect that already. And they're not standing still. They're innovating, like partnering with Goldman Sachs on new target date retirement funds that include private assets, trying to capture some of those higher fee alternative investment dollars.
And Invesco is making moves too with their big QQQ ETF.
Right. Invesco runs the massive QQQ ETF that tracks the NASDAQ 100. They're trying to convert its legal structure, which sounds technical, but the bottom line is it's expected to generate about $150 million more in annual revenue for Invesco, while also allowing them to slightly lower the fee for investors. A smart move to boost profitability on a core product.
Okay, now explain this phantom tax. It sounds like something that shouldn't exist.
It really shouldn't. It's this weird, unfair quirk in the tax code that hits people who own traditional mutual funds in regular taxable brokerage accounts, not IRAs or 401k.
Okay, so what happens?
Mutual funds, by law, have to distribute any capital gains they realize from trading stocks within the fund each year, even if you automatically reinvest those distributions back into more shares of the fund.
You still have to pay tax.
You still get a 1099 tax form and have to pay capital gains tax on that distributed amount that year, even if the fund's overall value actually went down.
Wait, So I could have $10,000, the fund distributes $1,000 in gains, which I reinvest, but the market tanks, and I end the year with only $8,500. I still owe taxes on that $1,000 I never actually saw as cash.
That's the phantom tax. Exactly. It's taxing reinvested paper gains, even amidst real losses. It mainly affects middle-class savers who hold funds outside of retirement accounts.
Is anything being done about it?
There's bipartisan legislation proposed called the Growth Act. It would basically fix this by letting investors defer paying tax on those reinvested capital gains until they actually sell their shares of the mutual fund.
Bringing it in line with how stocks and ETFs are treated.
Pretty much. It seems like a common sense fairness issue, and proponents say it should be roughly revenue neutral for the government in the long run.
Definitely sounds like a needed fix. Okay, let's move into our final section. What are the insiders, the activists, and the market veterans thinking and doing right now?
Yeah, always interesting to see where the smart money, or at least the informed money, is moving. Barron's flagged a few notable insider sales this week.
Like at AutoZone.
Right. Scott Murphy, the VP and controller at AutoZone, sold about $12 million worth of stock that he got through options. The timing looks less than ideal for the company.
Why? What was happening at AutoZone?
Well, the sale came right after AutoZone reported its fifth consecutive quarterly earnings miss. So performance is already shaky.
Okay.
And their results were specifically hit by an $80 million charge related to LIFO inventory accounting.
LIFO. Last in, first out.
Exactly. And that $80 million charge was directly blamed on the new 25% tariffs on imported auto parts. The tariffs forced them to recognize higher costs immediately, hitting profits. So an executive selling millions right after another earnings miss, which is directly linked to tariff impacts, it doesn't look great.
No, definitely not. What about that nuclear startup, Oklo? There was an insider sale there, too.
Yeah, Michael Stewart Klein, who's a director at Oklo, sold about $6.7 million worth of shares. And that sale happened just before the stock took a big 22% dive.
Ouch. Oklo's been a really high-flying stock, though, hasn't it?
Insanely high-flying, up over 400% this year, mostly on hype around small modular nuclear reactors. But they face huge hurdles. They want to deploy their first reactor by 2027 or 2028, but they don't even have an operating license yet, and they're burning through cash.
So an insider cashing out near the peak before a big drop.
Yeah, it suggests maybe even the insiders felt the valuation had gotten way ahead of the actual operational progress.
Were there any interesting activist investor moves where they're buying in, not selling out?
A couple mentioned. Juniper Investment boosted its stake in Orthofix Medical, which is a medical device company whose stock has been down. And Holdco Asset Management increased its position in Central Pacific Financial, a regional bank.
So activists seeing potential value to unlock there.
That's usually the signal, yeah.
Yeah.
They might push for changes, maybe even a sale of the company.
Okay, let's move from specific stocks to broader market wisdom. Barron's featured insights from Thomas Peterfy, the founder of Interactive Brokers. He's a real pioneer.
Absolutely. He practically invented electronic trading as we know it. His perspective is always fascinating.
What did he have to say about current market structure?
Well, he pointed out that big banks and trading firms report something like $200 billion in annual trading profits globally.
$200 billion just from trading.
Yeah. And his point is that huge number represents friction, basically costs that end up being paid by investors and the public. It shows there's still room for better execution, tighter spreads, more efficiency.
And he thinks the traditional trading day is outdated.
Completely. That 9:30 a.m. to 4:00 p.m. New York time window. He sees it as artificial in today's world. He fully expects that major globally followed stocks will eventually trade 24 hours a day, continuously. For big international stocks, night trading will just become the same as day trading.
The technology's there. It's just regulations lagging behind.
That's his view. The algorithms can run continuously. It's the market structure that needs to catch up.
Did he offer a view on the macro economy, despite all the debt concerns we talked about?
He's actually pretty optimistic. He sees the U.S. economy growing around 3%, helped by AI innovation and potentially reduced regulations.
What about tariffs? He seems to have a unique take.
He does. He actually likes the idea of tariffs creating a more level global playing field in principle. But he really dislikes President Trump's specific tactic of starting negotiations with these massive disruptive 100% tariffs, which just creates immediate chaos and uncertainty.
So nuanced support for the goal, dislike of the method.
Exactly. And interestingly, while Interactive Brokers offers crypto trading because clients demand it, Peter Simfy himself is still pretty skeptical. He said he expects some big disappointment in crypto eventually.
He also gave a really interesting technical explanation of the GameStop short squeeze, didn't he?
He did. He explained just how fragile the plumbing of the market was during that episode. He calculated that if the retail investors who were long GameStop had sold just one share when the price hit $400,
yeah,
the cash from that single share sale would have been enough to cover the margin loan requirements on something like 38 other shares they held. This would have forced a massive wave of broker buy-ins to cover positions. Theoretically, he said, it could have driven the price to infinity. It shows how close the system came to breaking under that specific kind of pressure.
Wow. That's a scary thought. Okay, finally, let's talk about gold. It's been on a tear.
A massive tear. Gold is up 43% year to date, absolutely crushing the S&P 500's 14% gain.
Why? What's driving the anti-anxiety asset, as Barron's calls it?
It's that whole cocktail of global worries we've been discussing. You know, the unpredictable tariff situation, the broader shift away from smooth globalization, fears that the AI stock market boom is a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, continued buying by central banks, especially China's central bank, which fuels ongoing speculation about the long-term future of the U.S. dollar as the main reserve currency. Gold thrives on uncertainty.
Is buying gold mining stocks the best way to play this?
Barron's actually suggests caution there. Yes, gold mining funds were the absolute top performers in the third quarter, up nearly 44%.
Yeah.
But historically,
yeah,
mining executives tend to get overexcited when prices are high. They take on too much debt, overexpand operations, and then often go bankrupt when gold prices eventually pull back. Physical bullion itself, or ETFs tracking it, is generally seen as the safer hedge because, well, gold bullion can't go bankrupt.
Makes sense. So for someone who wants exposure, but maybe not physical gold, and wants a defined risk, what kind of option strategy did they suggest?
They outlined a specific call spread strategy. It involves buying the January call option with a $360 strike price and simultaneously selling the January call option with a $375 strike price.
Okay, a bull call spread.
Exactly. You pay a net amount upfront, maybe around $5.25 per contract based on current prices. This lets you profit if gold goes up towards $375, but your maximum profit is capped at that level, and importantly, your maximum loss is limited to the $5.25 you paid initially.
So, defined risk, defined reward.
Right. The alternative they mentioned for someone who's actually willing to buy gold if it drops is selling a put option, like selling the January $340 put. You clicked a premium up front, maybe $5.80. If gold stays above $340, you just keep the premium. If it falls below $340, you're obligated to buy gold at that $340 price.
Got it. Okay, so pulling this all together from this week's Barron's, it paints a really clear but complex picture, doesn't it?
Very clear. You got capital markets just running incredibly hot. AI valuations are through the roof. Gold is soaring as people seek safety. M&A deals are booming. And it all seems fueled by this expectation of easy money from Fed rate cuts.
But, and it's a big but, we absolutely cannot ignore the costs and risks simmering underneath all that enthusiasm.
Not at all. We talked about those fundamental weaknesses creeping into the treasury market because of leveraged buyers. We see real stress in private credit. We see the financial pressure on families supporting adult kids.
And the big elephant in the room for AI profitability. Can it actually live up to the hype once you factor in those hundreds of billions in infrastructure costs?
That is the multi-trillion dollar question, isn't it? The initial revenue streams might just get swallowed whole by the capital expenditures needed to build and run these models.
So if the whole economy seems increasingly propped up by stock market gains flowing to the wealthy, and the market keeps ignoring weak economic data or political chaos, what's the final thought we should leave people with? What's the risk they need to watch?
Well, we've seen consumer spending stay surprisingly strong, largely because of those wealth gains from the stock market. And people feel richer, so they spend.
Mm.
But at the same time, official job growth numbers have really stalled out.
Mm.
There's this growing disconnect, this widening gap between the booming financial economy and the sort of sluggish real economy experienced by many people.
So the risk is that the market suddenly stops ignoring that gap.
That's the potential trigger. If that chasm between paper wealth and real-world job and wage growth gets too wide, or if some other piece of negative data finally breaks through, the market's current complacency could shatter really quickly. That's the underlying vulnerability you absolutely have to keep in mind right now.